has set the pace and tone for and the background for will begin with a panel of three. And I'm going to give a very brief introduction to all three of them and then let you hear from the first panelist, and then we will have a coffee break so that you can gather your thoughts together and sort of get accustomed to the format, and then hear from the other two panelists, and then we will have open discussion, and we will have plenty of time for it since we're running very closely on time. The first panelist that we will hear from this morning is John Haynes, and if I remind you latecomers that in the center of your program is our brief bios of the presenters, and if you'll look at those, we won't be repetitious with those. Besides what is said here about John Haynes, he is a specialist in 20th century political history in the Library of Congress. He also did his little piece for Minnesota's radicalism, I suspect, as a former assistant commissioner for tax policy in the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I think those ripples are still moving in Minnesota. And from 1981 to 89, he was editor of the newsletter of the Historians of American Communism. Dr. Haynes, would you join us, please, on the podium? And next we have Ode Lovell, who is professor of history at St. Olaf College. And in 1968, Dr. Lovell was awarded the Knight's Cross of the Royal Norwegian Order of Merit. His book, A Folk Epic, received the State Historical Society of Wisconsin Award of Merit in 1976. Dr. Lovell, would you please join us? Susanna Frankel is our third panelist. And Susanna's many media historical works, which are not mentioned in the bio in your printed program, include On the Banks of Cold Waters, Immigration to Northeastern Minnesota. And boy, I can relate to that since my parents immigrated right to the shores of Lake Superior, and I grew up on those cold waters. Also, her media presentation, History of the Jewish Community in Duluth in 84, and a wonderful three-part video, which is in the Duluth Public Library, Duluth's Architectural Heritage. She's also published a three-part series in Common Press entitled Toward a Cooperative Commonwealth. Welcome, Susanna, please. Those are our three panelists this morning. John?
I will be speaking this morning about the journal New Times, which was published in Minneapolis from late 1910 through 1918 and had a few final issues in the early part of 1919. For most of that period, it was the only English-language socialist journal in the state, and certainly throughout the period, it was the most widely circulated English Minnesota socialist paper. Now, to summarize a journal which published as much as New Times isn't easy. I'm not going to try in the time we have. Instead, I'm going to pick out what I think are a few key themes that I think deserve some attention in looking at the status of the Socialist Party and the particular kind of radicalism it articulated in this period. Now, New Times projected a confident view of the world. Scientific socialism, as New Times habitually referred to its basic principles, proved that, quote, the greater capitalists crush the smaller, the concentration of industry and wealth into fewer hands squeeze out millions of men. They drop into the working class. As a result, the working class is now in the overwhelming majority. It is constantly growing in numbers. It is constantly growing in conviction that it is entitled to the full value of its labor. It is constantly growing in the determination to translate the conviction into political action and actually secure the full value of its labor. These numbers, this conviction, and this determination make it invincible. Its triumph is inevitable. As for the Socialist Party's attainment of elective office, in the view of New Times, this was almost as guaranteed as the final coming of socialism. In 1916, New Times associate editor remarked, quote, the political awakening of the laborers is alarming the capitalists as nothing has yet done. They are few, the workers many. Once let the workers learn to vote for their own interest and elect their own representatives, and the supremacy of capitalism will be at an end. And to continue the quote, for the workers to secure political power is not difficult. It needs only that they unite consciously in one working class party for the definite purpose of securing political control. Thomas Van Leer, the Minnesota Socialist Party's leading political candidate, told his followers, quote, no working class in history has ever had the same political opportunity as we have on election day. One working man's vote is as good as Rockefeller's, and we are many and the capitalists are few. Now, all of this makes it seem quite simple. But as we know, socialism did not come within the time envisioned by New Times. Nor, in fact, did the Socialist Party ever do very well in most Minnesota elections. In 1912, the Socialist Party's gubernatorial candidate received somewhat under 26,000 votes, about 8%. He came in fifth, behind the prohibitionist candidate, behind the Bull Moose Progressive candidate, behind the Democratic Party's candidate, and behind the Republican candidate. His vote, by the way, was about the same as Eugene Debs' vote in the Minnesota presidential election, 8%. This unimpressive performance was the high point of socialist voting in statewide elections in Minnesota. Nor, would I argue, was there a socialist triumph in Minneapolis, despite Thomas Van Leer's impressive victory in the 1916 contest for mayor. Van Leer was a socialist, and he ran as a socialist. Although the election, one should note, were technically nonpartisan, the ballots were nonpartisan. His election, nevertheless, was, in my view, a victory for socialism only in the narrow sense that the winning candidate was a member of the Socialist Party. To be sure, Van Leer's election was, in part, a socialist victory. But it was also, in part, a personal victory of a veteran municipal politician. Van Leer had run in every Minneapolis election since 1910. It was, in part, simply an expression of the growing power of reform sentiment in the state at the time. And probably in its greatest part, it was a success of a growing, aggressive, largely non-socialist trade union movement in Minneapolis. If Van Leer's campaign had significant socialist content, one would expect to find it in New Times. New Times, after all, was published in Minneapolis. Van Leer and New Times were aligned together in the often acrimonious factionalism of the Minnesota Socialist Party. And New Times ardently promoted his electoral campaigns in every election in which he took part. But a close reading of New Times shows, in my view, that Van Leer's 1916 campaign was largely a reform campaign that used the same issues and much of the same rhetoric used by non-socialist, progressive, and reform candidates of the era. Now, due to the press of time, I'm not going to spend a great deal of this talk about that, except to say that throughout New Times in the period from 1910 through Van Leer's election, you find a very extraordinary stress on municipal reform issues, particularly corruption in the Minneapolis Police Department, vice and racketeering in the Minneapolis Saloon and Entertainment District, inefficiency in city government, and above all else, the fierce debate about renewal of the franchise for the streetcar company. Now, going into the election, let me also remind you the Socialist Party had four adherents among the 24 Minneapolis aldermen and claimed one state legislator from the city. When the 1916 election was over, the number of socialist aldermen remained 4 out of 24, no change. The number of state legislators from Minneapolis who were socialists remained 1, no change. In addition to Van Leer's office, the SP only gained one seat in the election, a seat on the school board. Now, Van Leer's election was headlined in New Times as, quote, epoch-making struggle shows in working-class victory. But in its actual text, New Times showed a perhaps better perspective on what had happened. Quote, the election returns cannot be said to be a victory for socialism in the sense that all of these casting their vote for the socialist candidate for mayor were also voting for a complete cooperative system of wealth production and distribution. New Times added, quote, we must face the fact that the big and wonderfully gratifying vote for our mayoralty candidate is a shifting one. The streetcar franchise issue was an important, perhaps even decisive, one. The streetcar franchise issue 2 years hence, when the question will probably be settled, will not be there, and large numbers of voters may go back to their old loves, capitalist party candidates. And in fact, as we know, 2 years later they did, and Van Leer failed re-election. Now, the period of the Socialist Party's rise and fall in Minnesota was one of political ferment and the breakdown of traditional established partisan alignments. Now, let's remember, in 1912, and we're talking about Minnesota, when at the National Republican Party Convention, the majority of Minnesota delegates bolted the party to join Theodore Roosevelt's Progressive Party. And in the general election, Roosevelt carried Minnesota. Wilson came in second, and Taft, Republican candidate, came in third. Voters did elect the Republican governor, the incumbent Alfred Eberhardt, but only with a plurality of 40% of the vote. Prohibitionists were strong in both parties, as well as an independent political force, and prohibitionist tickets gained large votes in the elections throughout this period. As early as 1910, 4 independent prohibitionists were elected to the Minnesota legislature. Let me add, in the same election, the Socialist Party was only able to elect 1 member of the legislature. Now, the Republicans' factionalism was bad enough. The Democratic Party's factionalism was, if anything, worse. Its dominant progressive wing was largely dry, and this weakened Democratic voting habits among the largely wet German-American constituency, which was a source before this time of Democratic strength. Nationality tensions, a powerful source of political division in ethnically diverse Minnesota, were further increased by World War I. By 1916, Governor Hammond, a Democrat, was questioning the patriotism of the German-American Alliance, the leading German ethnic organization in the state. In that same year, a brawl broke out on the train carrying Minnesota's delegates to the National Democratic Convention, and that brawl aptly illustrated Democratic factionalism. America's entry into the war in 1917 further eroded German-American support for the Democrats, as many of them blamed the Democrats, Wilson, for getting the nation into a war with the German fatherland. Even so, these unhappy German Americans could not find a welcome in the Republican Party. By this time, the Republicans under Governor Bernquist had adopted a stance of hyper-patriotism, harshly attacked German culture, and harassed anyone who failed to show sufficient enthusiasm for the war. This political tumult was a time ripe for political realignment. The Socialist Party nonetheless played only a contributing role in that realignment. The chief initiator of change was the Farmers' Nonpartisan League. A nonpartisan league ticket lost in the 1918 Republican gubernatorial primary, but its vote was quite substantial. The NPL then went on to form an alliance with a politically aroused segment of the trade union movement and ran an independent farmer-labor ticket in the general election. The farmer-labor slate lost, but came in a very respectable second, pushed the Democrats into a humiliating third place. Now, the socialist role in all of this was principally as furnishing many of the leaders of those trade unions that provided the urban and working class wing of the farmer labor movement. These farmer labor socialists, however, were socialists who had given up on the Socialist Party itself. Now, I think in the midst of all this political turmoil, one might ask, why did the Socialist Party win so few votes? Why did most Minnesota workers vote for other parties? They voted for the Republicans, they voted for the Democrats, they voted for the progressives. They even voted more for the prohibitionists than they did for the Socialist Party. Now, New Times wondered about this. They asked themselves that because the election returns were there for everyone to see. Well, New Times gave various answers to this. It frequently articulated the idea that workers were ill-informed, stupid, foolish, or in some cases, as they get more frustrated, morally debased. New Times said in one headline, "The only enemy is ignorance of the masses, and if only workers heard the revolutionary message, the Socialist Party would triumph." Now, this argument, which was strong in the earlier years, became harder to maintain as the years went by and the circulation of thousands of copies of socialist pamphlets, books, and the running of socialist candidates in dozens and dozens of elections. New Times' irritation with the, quote, heedless throng who failed to listen to the socialist message eventually resulted in an increasing amount of comment on the stupidity and foolishness of workers. In 1914, New Times printed a cartoon labeled "The Man Who Will Never Become a Socialist." The cartoon showed a simple-looking worker saying, "I don't know nothing, I don't want nothing." Now keep in mind, they're talking about the majority of workers. During Van Leer's mayoral campaign, New Times ridiculed workers who supported Van Leer's opponents as an ignorant James Workstiff. New Times described the archetypical Workstiff as someone who, quote, doesn't care much about the election, thinks Brooklyn will win the series, doesn't know much about socialism, doesn't care anything about it. The father, meaning a priest, the father says socialists are no good, never read anything on the subject, and by God, he never will. Jim Workstiff says, them socialists is again religion. I'm going to vote for Nye or Langham. Those were Van Leer's opponents. Now, Van Leer himself told workers that the capitalists, quote, can only rule by fooling the working man into voting for their candidate. He indicated his fears about the susceptibility of workers to manipulation by coupling his comments with a plea to workers that they don't do it. Well, with the notable exception of Van Leer's own 1916 election, most workers, in fact, did do it. That is, they kept voting for non-socialists. This phenomenon increasingly produced expressions of scorn for the character of those workers, the majority who failed to vote socialist. In 1915, an obviously frustrated editor of New Times described overhearing two workers on a streetcar talking heatedly about baseball. He commented, quote, "I know that these men are typical of the working class. Thousands may starve, yet they are interested in baseball. Little children may be enslaved and help destroying factories. They worry about the scores. What fools these workers are." An equally telling remark is that of A.L. Sugarman, who was shortly to become state secretary of the Socialist Party. He wrote, quote, "So low has labor sunk that the typical worker was a shabby, quote, human wreck, cringing before the plutocrat." In 1914, New Times placed in its editorial column a poem titled "The Worker Unawake." It described the working class as, quote, "Not dead, yet hardly yet alive, a thing inert. He plods his little round, now sad, now gay, nor dreams he of the larger life, the thrill of social consciousness. He lives unto himself from meat to meat, from sleep to sleep, obsequious. The horror of this world, the terrible insanity that damns a thousand lives with toil, that one may be damned with ease, troubles him not. Well fed, he snores, or being hungry, whines. Quick to the master's beck, he timely bows, praises the hand that robs him, kisses the heel that leads him in the mire. He, the most robbed of all, robbed of his birthright of audacity, a slave in soul too steep to dream of aught but slavery, he, not the exploiter, is the heavy ball upon the chain that clogs humanity." Well, Minnesota workers, in terms of their voting, were the heavy ball upon the chain that kept the Socialist Party from its task assigned by scientific socialism. I am not, however, inclined to agree with those frustrated socialists in New Times who assigned the failure to workers' ignorance, foolishness, and debasement. A reading of New Times suggests to me that the Socialist Party did not do better because its vision of American society and of American workers was fundamentally at variance and at key points offensive to the worldview held by most workers. Now, I would like to summarize a few of those themes that one can find in New Times that, to my mind, indicate a very serious clash between the world as seen by New Times and the world as seen and experienced by most Minnesota workers. The first area I would point to is nationality, ethnicity, and patriotism. Many, I think probably most, of Minnesota's working class were of immigrant origin at the time. In fact, this is reflected in Minnesota's own Socialist Party with its various Finnish, German, Scandinavian, Greek, Russian, Jewish, Hungarian, and Latvian socialist locals. Native speakers of English were a minority. And although a number of socialist newspapers were published in Minnesota, New Times was, as I mentioned, for many years the only English language socialist paper. Now, partially as a result of the great emphasis in academic history in recent years about immigration history and social history, we know that the immigration experience was a defining phenomenon for several generations of Americans. Immigrants left a distinct national culture and entered America and became part of an often very different society. They did not, however, simply drop their own nationality and adopt the customs of the new country. Instead, a rather complex interaction took place that changed everybody concerned. One of the most significant results of this process was the emergence of ethnic communities that, although partially integrated into mainstream American society, nonetheless had internal leadership, internal structure, and developed ethnic culture and society, and supported a variety of ethnic churches and other social institutions. If one read only New Times, one would never guess that such a process was underway. New Times, of course, noted the existence of the language locals of the Socialist Party, and even from time to time complained that the Finns were using their numerical weight to become the kingmakers of the State Socialist Party. And although New Times had several editors in its, during its time, for most of its years, its editor was Alexis Georgian, who was himself an immigrant from Russia. Even so, to New Times, the various language locals were simply clubs of workers who spoke some other language than English. In the eyes of New Times, these workers did not have nationality, or what today we'd call ethnicity. According to New Times, workers had no country, and they were, language difficulties excepted, interchangeable. All through the period we are discussing, there was, particularly after World War I began, a fierce debate in American society over Americanization and on the legitimacy of the hyphen issue, that is, of ethnicity of German Americans, Italian Americans, and so forth. Most journals of the day took part in the debate over Americanization and hyphenization. There was no debate in New Times. It simply was not there at all. Now, some might say that New Times, as an English language socialist paper, did not need to concern itself with ethnicity. I don't think that's correct. For one thing, New Times' obliviousness to ethnicity reflected a fairly widespread socialist attitude, particularly among its upper leadership. Second, any movement that aspired to significant political power had to deal with ethnicity either by learning to play ethnic politics or by way of playing ethnic politics in a negative fashion, by arousing nativist constituencies in opposition to one or another of the emerging hyphenated communities. One certainly did not do, as New Times did during the Van Leer campaign, ridicule immigrants who supported Van Leer's Swedish-American opponent, that was Otto S. Langham, as a dim-witted immigrant Olaf Swanson, and attributed to the archetypical Swanson remarks, and I'm not very good at dialect, so bear with me, "I tank I vote for Otto. He bang goods feed. I tank we beat these harsh socialists." New Times, in this remark and in many others, was blind to ethnicity and thereby blind to a key factor in many workers' self-identity and voting choices. Now, if New Times was merely oblivious to immigrant workers' nationality and culture, it was positively hostile to American nationality. New Times' attack on American patriotism reflected, I suppose, in a negative fashion, some realization of the sway of American nationalism over most Native American workers. Well, New Times dealt with American workers' patriotic sentiments by ridiculing it. In 1911, the first year New Times had an opportunity to comment on the July 4th celebration, it featured on its front page an article saying, quote, "One of the most ridiculous spectacles in the world is the American working class on the 4th of July. The essay denounced the American Revolution and asserted that it had been principally undertaken by New Englanders to protect the slave trade. On the occasion of the next July the 4th, New Times called the founding fathers of the American Revolution, quote, smugglers, described George Washington as a land speculator, and dismissed Thomas Jefferson as a, quote, unscrupulous land grabber. Nor was July the 4th the only symbol of patriotism that earned New Times scorn. The American flag, it was, quote, a piece of cloth that represents the system that is oppressing us wage slaves. As for the Constitution, New Times highlighted a speech at local Minneapolis where, quote, Comrade Lucas proceeded to tear the Constitution of the United States to pieces and lay open to the public the utter worthlessness of it. New Times shortly followed that comment with a lengthy article denouncing the Constitution and stating, quote, the Socialist Party should have no more respect for the Constitution than for J.P. Morgan's instructions to his valet. Now, to the scorn or indifference to workers' nationality, New Times added hostility to religion. Religion and church activities were important aspects of the lives of many workers, both old stock, native-born workers, and immigrants. Often churches were major pillars of the developing ethnic communities of immigrant workers. But at no point in the existence of New Times can one find understanding or respect for religious belief. Now, in its early years, New Times occasionally patronized religious sentiment rather than attacking it directly. In a 1910 essay, New Times said, quote, Jesus was a working man and he represented the working people of his day. Early in 1911, New Times reported on a socialist lecture by a Protestant minister who called himself a member of a creedless church and who saw Fabian socialism as the embodiment of Christianity. In a similar way, it approvingly reported on a lecture by a rabbi who explained that, properly understood, the Old Testament endorsed socialism. And New Times urged that socialists celebrate Christmas by interpreting Jesus' life according to socialist ideals. Equally patronizing was a Van Leer lecture to an audience of Baptists, in which he told the Baptists that religious belief was a, quote, luxury that should be indulged only after economic justice had been achieved. These discussions were so devoid of understanding of religious experience that readers of New Times with serious religious attachment likely found them offensive rather than comforting. In any case, New Times was rather more comfortable with direct attacks on religion, as in an editorial that religious instruction was, quote, injurious to the social life as well as to the life of individuals, or in a front page cartoon entitled The Holy Trio, where three disreputable-looking figures are labeled, quote, Father, Son, and the Ghost, and represented the plutocrat saying, we rule you, the policeman saying, we club you, and the priest saying, we fool you. Three headlines on anti-religious stories, quote, old ecclesiastical dope for workers endure hell here for heaven hereafter, quote, Catholicism, the enemy of human progress, and, quote, religion is good slave doctrine, catches the general flavor of New Times' attitude. There were, in fact, dozens and dozens of anti-religious articles. One New Times story summed all of it up in a statement that churches and clergy, quote, have condemned, burned, and made life miserable for justice-loving and truth-seeking minds. They have and are still polluting the mind of unfortunate men, women, and children who fall into these black-garbed, hypocritical monsters' traps. Now, in 1916, New Times editorial entitled Why Working Men Do Not Go to Church asserted that workers were abandoning their churches in large numbers because the work of the churches on behalf of capitalism was making, quote, the name Christian a term of reproach. There are two notable aspects about this editorial. First, the assertion that workers were leaving the churches was likely incorrect. There's nothing to indicate that they were. Second, and this is the bizarre part, in the very same issue, New Times noted that Socialist Party membership in Minnesota had fallen from 5,227 in 1914 to 3,547 in 1916, a 32% drop. One might think that New Times would be more concerned about why workers were abandoning the Socialist Party than advancing the idea that the common man was abandoning the churches. Well, New Times' disregard for nationalism and hostility to religion illustrate two major areas where, in my view, the views of many, perhaps most workers, clashed with those of New Times. There are additional aspects of New Times' worldview that I think show that, in a sense, it lived in a different universe from that of most Minnesota workers. Now, from 1911 to 1915, New Times published 11 harsh attacks on the Boy Scout movement. New Times said, quote, the plutocrats of America invented and are promoting the Scout organization for the purpose of defeating the worldwide movement for peace. And, quote, the Boy Scouts of America are taught and are expected to kill father, mother, brother, sister, or anyone else in obedience to their superior. New Times asserted that the Boy Scouts were trained to break strikes and prominently reported that the socialist-led machinist local passed a resolution denouncing the Scout movement as immoral and constituted, quote, a wholesale murder machine. Now, in the 19-teens, the Boy Scout movement was still young and had not yet become as American as Mom, Apple Pie, and the Flag, but it was already well on its way to that status. It is also the case that in this early period, the Boy Scout movement modeled itself on military forms more than it did in its later maturity. Even so, New Times' view of the Scout movement suggests a essentially distorted grasp of American society and a failure to see why the Scout movement caught on with such speed and had such amazing popularity at such a young age. Now, until 1916, the New Times had generally adhered to the moderate wing of the Socialist Party and had denounced the use of violence. And Van Leer, as I noted earlier, had emphasized reforming the police and ending criminal activity as a major part of his 1916 campaign. But under the pressure of war, New Times and the Minnesota SP moved in a more radical direction. Often, I think these radical views expressed ideas that were highly objectionable to a number of Minnesota workers. In 1916, New Times published a letter from A.L. Sugarman attacking a prior New Times editorial that had denounced the IWW's support for violent confrontation. Sugarman argued, quote, "An occasional stick of dynamite used wisely can accomplish great things for the working class," and said, quote, "This is the attitude of an ever-increasing left wing of the Minnesota socialist movement." In a second letter in New Times, Sugarman again endorsed dynamite and said, quote, "Emery dust in vital parts was an excellent way to conduct a strike." He signed his letter, quote, "Yours for direct and political action and intelligent violence when necessary." Now, in 1917, a more moderate socialist published a letter in New Times that objected to Sugarman and said that Sugarman, in fact, praised criminals. Sugarman replied in a letter in New Times, which he said, quote, "Mr. Carton says that I sympathize with crooks. I do. I still hold that the criminal is far more courageous than the worker who submissively starves. He, the criminal, is courageous. He defies all society, acts to preserve himself." Sherman went on to call for revolutionary ethics and commented that right and wrong are entirely relative things. The working class must develop a code of ethics all its own. Now remember, Sugarman is not some crank letter writer. Within a short amount of time, he was elected state secretary of the Socialist Party and subsequently won a recall referendum aimed at his removal. The significant point here is that I very much doubt that a majority of Minnesota workers, who were largely law-abiding, regarded criminals as courageous or regarded themselves as lacking in courage because they failed to commit criminal acts. Now, there are some other issues which, for reasons of time, I will not go into. To the debate was minimal. Nor do we have time to go into New Times' attacks on marriage as a barbaric institution. Let me close with this. A reading of New Times suggests that the Socialist Party in Minnesota made only limited inroads into its chosen constituency because its view of the world was in key aspects unacceptable to a majority of workers. The political ferment of the period, the popularity of progressivism and the attraction of voters to the emerging farmer labor movement's economic radicalism indicate that the Socialist Party's failure was not due to the unwillingness of voters to try new political alignments or their lack of receptivity to their critique of the economic system. The problem was that the Socialist Party of this period asked a lot more of voters than simply giving up old political loyalties and using the power of government to change the economic system. The Socialist Party, as expressed through New Times, explicitly and implicitly expected voters to give up their flag, give up their churches, put aside particular national and ethnic cultures, and take on the persona of the theoretical ideological worker of the New Times image. The New Times made clear that a worker's only significant characteristic was his status as a proletarian, and this status alone explained everything of significance about his life. Whether a worker's economic status should be regarded as the overwhelming factor of his life is an ethical question. Whether he did in this period regard himself in this fashion is a historic question. The evidence is that Minnesota workers and American workers in general did not. Certainly, they identified themselves as workers part of the time, formally through unions, organized strikes, or more informally through individual actions and shop floor activity. Minnesota American workers contested with foremen, managers, and owners over economic remuneration and for control of the workplace. But this aspect of a worker's life was, however, only a part of his life, and he often viewed it as an instrument to obtaining his goals in other areas. The other parts of his life were not bound up to the status of being a worker except through the instrumental connection to earning income. These other parts of life involving family, church, politics, ethnic institutions, a variety of voluntary activities and organizations, and increasingly over time, the consumption of consumer goods made possible by economic growth were of more concern. In 1912, New Times headlined its report on Van Leer's assertion to the Baptist that religion was a luxury with the socialist cliche, quote, all issues are class issues. The Socialist Party's trouble was that most workers in Minnesota at that time didn't see it that way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Now we'll have an opportunity for you to give a slightly more accurate, hopefully, reflection of these times than New Times did by filling out an evaluation form at some point today. And we heard then our next speaker, who I previously did introduce and gave you some background on, and recall that there is more in your information pamphlet, in your program, is Ode Lovell. Ode.
Yeah, thank you. Socialism is coming. The radical Minneapolis newspaper, Gopo Forward, announced optimistically on its front page following the election of 1910. According to the newspaper's own calculations, the red banner, as Gopo stated, had moved 70% closer toward its goal of destroying capitalism. And indeed, Gopo was simply echoing the optimism created by the steady growth of the Socialist Party of America since its founding in 1901. At its height in 1912, the party had 118,000 registered members and elected 1,200 public officials throughout the United States. Gopo represented the party's Dano-Norwegian voice. The surge of support for socialism gave it an impressive circulation of 5,000 by 1912, and in the election of 1914, moved Andrew O. Devil into the Minnesota legislature as the very first socialist member of that body. Devil was by then listed as editor and publisher together with the newspaper's founder, Emil Lauritz Mengshol. The launching of Gopo was closely associated with the radical newspaper enterprise of J.A. Weyland in the 1890s, The Coming Nation and the Appeal to Reason. From 1897, Weyland published the latter journal in Girard, Kansas. Both publications reached unprecedented circulations for socialist organs in the United States and were a part of a movement that expressed itself in the founding of socialist colonies and the formation of socialist clubs and societies. Weyland exhibited strong proclivities toward Northern European immigrants and a clear antipathy toward Catholics among the working classes, which convinced him to attempt publishing a Scandinavian newspaper for the American scene. At Weyland's invitation, Mengshol came to Girard in 1903 to start Gopo. Weyland had by then changed his mind about publishing the newspaper himself, but he gave generous assistance to Mengshol, who was able to get out the first issue of Gopo in November of that year. The life story of Mengshol and the existing misinformation surrounding it has been clarified in an excellent Norwegian academic thesis by Oddstein Granhus. Mengshol's formative years were difficult, born as he was out of wedlock in 1866 at the small town of Jøvik on the shores of Lake Mjøsa, to a 42-year-old widowed mother of low social status and an irresponsible father 20 years her junior, a younger son from the large Mengshol farm close to Jøvik. From the age of 10, Mengshol lived there, though under the stigma of illegitimacy. At age 18, he escaped from this unfortunate situation and enrolled at the School for Non-Commissioned Officers in Christiania, Norway's capital city, graduating in 1887. It was while a student at this school that he encountered the brutal use of military units to break up strikes, as well as socialist ideas and protests against using military force against workers, spread by the newspaper Vårt Arbeide, Our Labor. It was the initial organ of the trade unions in the Norwegian capital, which were strongly influenced by socialism. The newspaper was distributed in the barracks where the students lived, and its message of class struggle and social injustice was well received by the students, who mainly came from the lower social classes. Mengshol removed himself further from unfortunate circumstances at home by going to sea in 1888. There he experienced the maltreatment commonly the lot of ordinary sailors. In 1891, he jumped ship in Pensacola, Florida, to begin a new life in America. Here he pursued his considerable intellectual interest by entering Norwegian-American journalism. Before coming to Girard in 1903, he had expressed his social and political radicalism in the columns of the newspaper Nye Nordmanden, the New Norseman, a radical populist organ started by Hans A. Foss in Moorhead, Minnesota in 1894, and the next year moved to Minneapolis. It was edited for some time by Olav Kringen and then by Mengsel, who here gained experience in newspaper publishing. Kringen shortly returned to his native Norway and became a leading personality in the Norwegian Labour Party and editor of its official organ, Socialdemokraten, the Social Democrat. Kringen contributed to Gåpo and conducted personal correspondence with its publisher, most especially towards the end of the newspaper's history. He thereby allied Gåpo with the moderate reform wing of the Norwegian Labour Party, to which he himself belonged, and which advocated social democratic processes. Helle Kroeger Mengsel, whom Mengsel married in 1899, became a major co-worker in Gåpo, which basically remained a family venture. She had been born into a distinguished family in Bergen and divorced from Nils Devold, a prominent family of textile mill owners in Norway, with whom she had three children. Before emigrating to the United States in 1893, she had attended meetings of the Christiania Workers' Society together with her young son, Andrew Olav, and took part in organizing strike activity. Andrew Olav Devold became a force in Gåpo. His career in Minnesota politics illustrated how ethnic political activism affected the political climate of the state. In 1904, the Mengsels moved Gåpo to Minneapolis, which presumably would give a firmer base for Norwegian language socialist publishing than Girard had. Gåpo was consistently close to the ideological views of the Socialist Party of America and loyally printed the party's program on its front page. Until the appearance of Socialdemokraten in Chicago in 1911, Gåpo was the only socialist journal that appealed directly to Danish and Norwegian workers in the common Dano-Norwegian literary language. From the last part of the 19th century, the promise of America was increasingly sought in an urban and industrialized America for Norwegians as well as for the masses of other immigrants arriving from Europe. By 1910, 16,401 Norwegian-born residents lived in Minneapolis and another 4,063 in St. Paul. The heaviest concentration in Minneapolis was in the old Sixth Ward, within easy walking distance of the central business and warehouse districts of the city. Within this ward, 55% of the Norwegian-born men were employed in skilled, semi-skilled, or unskilled blue-collar occupations. These workers exhibited working-class loyalties, and perhaps, as the historian has suggested, rejecting an ideology of success, took part in working-class organizing and union movements. These workers would be the obvious target for a socialistic enterprise like Gåpo, which, as historian Carl H. Krislak has stated, commanded, quote, some influence in Twin City working-class wards. September 16, 1911, Gåpo reported on the second meeting of the Scandinavian Socialist Society, where the veteran radical Lars Stavenheim had spoken, and commented that at the meeting there had been, quote, many souls but one conviction. Devold was active in this organization as he had been in an earlier disbanded one. The columns of Gåpo give ample evidence of socialist activity in Minneapolis and St. Paul, in cultural and social events, meetings, rallies, and organizational life. Through the prism of a socialist organ, the Scandinavian community is seen in a different light than in such publications as Minneapolis Tidende and Decora Posten, which Gåpo dismissed as reactionary capitalist papers, Bagstrævarbladet. In the 1890s, Scandinavians in Minneapolis had given strong support to populism, and it was also in the populist wheat belt in western Minnesota, especially in the Red River Valley, that Gåpo found a responsive audience, suggesting that many Norwegians joined the socialist cause after the failed populist movement. And perhaps, as Helle Mengsel stated in correspondence to Olav Kringen in Norway in 1919, the latter districts provided the majority of the newspaper subscribers. Nevertheless, Gåpo reflected the idea of common objectives and political alliance of the farmer and the laborer, which later gave birth to the Farmer Labor Party. But Gåpo found a readership far beyond the bounds of Minnesota and had regular correspondence in several parts of North Dakota, in Seattle and Astoria, Oregon, another hotbed of Scandinavian radicalism, as well as an office in Chicago. When the newspaper earned a reputation of being the most radical Norwegian-American socialist newspaper, this was more due to Mengsel's militant style and consistent use of Marxist terminology, as well as the ridicule this produced in more conservative Norwegian circles, than of any real advocacy of a revolutionary upheaval against the capitalist system. In fact, Mengsel's concept of class struggle was largely confined to the political arena, the use of the ballot, and a strong faith in the power of education, which he thought would convince the electorate of an ultimate victory for the socialism because of its inherent rightness and social justice. While appealing to class consciousness in Marxist terms, Goeppel rejected the idea of direct action and sabotage advocated by elements within the radical industrial workers of the world and industrial conflicts, embraced the nonviolent plank adopted by the Socialist Party in 1912. The political process would, Mengsel believed, transform America into a socialist society. In these views, he might have been as much influenced by Edward Bellamy's utopian society in his Looking Backward as by the revolutionary ideas in Karl Marx's Das Kapital. In a pragmatic fashion, Mengsel insisted that farmers were not a part of the capitalist class, but natural allies of the working class. And on occasion, he even called on small businessmen to join the two other groups to defeat capitalism. Only by a popular appeal could socialist rule have any chance of materializing. The working classes alone could not do it. In his beliefs, Mengsel owed much to social democratic ideologies in Norway and Scandinavia in general. These included a pragmatic reform of socialism, confidence in the power of education, and a broad appeal to all anti-capitalist groups, urban workers to be sure, but also rural laborers, small farmers, and fishermen. Goeppel and his readers benefited not only from the views of Ola Kringen, but also from direct correspondence with such other luminaries in the Norwegian Labor Party as Christian Holtermann Knudsen, as the editor of Vårt Arbeide, considered to be the founder of the social democratic movement in Norway, and with Carl Jeppesen, one of the founders of the Norwegian Labor Party in 1887, and the first editor of Socialdemokraten, the successor to Vårt Arbeide. One of Minnesota's most effective socialist agitators was undoubtedly A.O. Devold, who argued the cause of socialism eloquently in Norwegian as well as in English. His extensive tour on behalf of the State Socialist Party before the election in 1912 is noteworthy, and it was faithfully reported over many issues of Goeppel under the title In the Service of the Party. The coverage identified rather well the extent of Scandinavian socialist activity in the districts he visited. In Thief River Falls, for instance, which Devold visited in June, Scandinavian comrades controlled the city council. And when Devold discovered that even the chief of police was a Norwegian comrade, he uttered in surprise, "Fan, damn." the goal of the socialists in this heavily Norwegian district was to replace the progressive Republican congressman Halvor Stenersen of Crookston, also Norwegian, with comrade M.A. Bratland, another Norwegian politician. The Protestant middle class character of progressivism, which Stenersen stood for, probably represented the political opinion of the majority of Norwegian Americans in the Midwest during the progressive era. Not until the farmer labor tide in 1922 was Stenersen actually retired from public life. Devold's election to the Minnesota House in 1914 and the Senate in 1918 on the socialist ticket made him a prominent player in developments that funneled protest movements into a farmer labor coalition and the formation of the Farmer Labor Party. He was also sympathetic to the Nonpartisan League, where the FLP had its roots. The North Dakota Republican Nonpartisan League, founded in 1915, adopted a platform of state ownership of elevators, mills, and credit banks, which embodied the chief features of the Socialist Party of North Dakota, a political unit that functioned fairly well from 1908 until 1914. It was the NPL's effort to enter Minnesota politics and duplicate its successes in North Dakota there that engaged Devold and Goeppel Devold left Goeppel in 1917, but as Oddstein Granus writes, he, quote, formed a symbiotic relationship with the newspaper. It printed his reports and speeches on the front page, while his prestige in state politics gave Goeppel credibility and influence. In March 1918, Goeppel opened its columns to Sigvard Rørvik, the Norwegian correspondent at the Nonpartisan League office in St. Paul, and endorsed the League and its program of reform. In the election that year, Gopa naturally gave strong support to Devil's successful bid for the Senate and the socialist Thomas von Leer's failed attempt at re-election in Minneapolis. But it also gave cautious endorsement to the NPL candidate for the governorship, Charles A. Lindbergh. Quote, in these peculiar times, Mengsel editorialized, we cannot but support the Nonpartisan League's call to, quote, vote for the Nonpartisan League's plank, vote for Lindbergh. Gopa harshly condemned mob actions against Lindbergh during the election campaign in some Minnesota communities, and his arrest in Martin County on charges of illegal assembly and advocacy of international socialism was described as the last desperate action of the capitalist class in order to rid itself of a troublesome man. The newspaper's defense of Lindbergh made it the target of vandals and gave cause for extra surveillance by state authorities. NPL candidates were regularly accused by their adversaries of disloyalty, sedition, and socialism, even though an implied understanding might be said to have existed between the socialists and the NPL in the 1918 election, the Socialist Party objected on principle to the NPL platform, and Mengsel's accommodation to its policy and candidates caused some displeasure with fellow socialists. Simultaneously, his position demonstrated an independent and pragmatic approach, the main consideration being to rid the state, quote, of local junkers. Gopa was, at the time, entering a critical juncture which threatened its existence. And in October 1918, it became a casualty of the conservative warfare on socialists when it lost its second-class mailing privilege. After the outbreak of World War I in the summer of 1914, Gopa had moved with the Socialist Party of America to an attitude of strong opposition to American involvement in the hostilities, which only intensified with United States' entry into the war in April 1917. It expressed a continued faith in the power of international worker solidarity to prevent capitalist interests from waging war and gave wholehearted support to the socialist peace movement. Gopa quite naturally criticized all forms of civil repression, such as the arrest and imprisonment of its agent in Seattle, Olof Berlt, and Carl Altin, editor of the Swedish IWW newspaper Alarm, for their anti-war and anti-draft propaganda. It denounced mob disruption of socialist peace rallies and raids on IWW offices. Gopa also voiced strong exception to the creation of the Minnesota Commission of Public Safety in April 1917, which it feared would further suppress civil liberties and the rights of labor. On the anti-war issue, Devold vacillated uneasily between an anti-war and a pro-war stance. But his opposition to the Safety Commission was firm, as was his attacks on capitalist war profiteering. Developments in Russia gave an added issue to the newspaper. To Devold and to Mengsel, as explained in Gopa, the revolution in Russia in March or February 1917 signaled, quote, a new dawn in the East. The democratic reform introduced by the provisional government made Russia, according to Gopa, one of the freest nations in the world, and used this claim to ridicule the curtailment of civil liberties in the United States. Hopeful signs could be detected as well in the emerging workers' democracies in the North, and closer to home in the farm revolt in the Northwest and in worker activism. Quote, the proletariat's future is ours, the workers and the farmers, Devil declared confidently in September 1917. The seizure of power by the Bolsheviks in November 1917 was also hailed joyfully by Gopa, which lauded the new government for its fidelity to the Russian worker. John Glumbeck, a socialist writer, explained in the columns of Gopa how the war had actually liberated the worker and promoted socialism in many lands, among these Germany, whose reactionary capitalist government, to quote socialist literature, many radicals now argued had to be defeated in order to save the Russian Revolution. This change in attitude allowed socialists like Devold to move gracefully to support the administration and its goals as expressed in President Wilson's peace proposal, which he presented to Congress in early January 1918. This proposal embodied the socialist principles of no annexation and no indemnities, and endorsed a declaration of support of the peace plan by a mass meeting of Minneapolis socialists. As Goapo was silenced shortly before the armistice on November 11, 1918, a hiatus of 2 months was created in his commentary on world and local events. It reappeared again with a Christmas issue on December 21, 1918, with the name changed to Folkets Röst, significantly translated as the voice of the people, on the masthead just below the Norwegian title. And it did not move to Chicago, as the program incorrectly states. It continued to be printed in Minneapolis until 1925. The new name had significance on two levels. It was a less blatant socialist appellative, and it can be said to reflect political reality at that time, the national as well as the local situation within the state of Minnesota. During the national hysteria and intolerance of the Red Scare of 1919, a socialist newspaper like Folkets Röst had little freedom of action. And Mengsel, whose sole means of livelihood the newspaper was, showed a new degree of restraint in his editorial policy. Yet the manifestations of the Red Scare in dealing with strikes, arrest of radicals, and deportation of aliens on the political left were severely criticized. Special coverage given to Norwegians who were deported, as was the formation in June 1919 of the America Committee of Minneapolis, whose purpose it was to fight Bolshevism and radical socialism. Nevertheless, Folkets Röst, revealing its broad appeal to the people, opposed the radicalization of the Socialist Party. The meeting in Chicago in August, September 1919, where a split in the party occurred in the formation of two communist groups, which united later in 1921, was reported under the heading, quote, "The Spirit of Unrest." The majority of the Scandinavian Socialist Federation in Chicago voted for the Third International. It thereby followed the move of the Norwegian Labor Party, the only social democratic party in Western Europe to adopt the Moscow thesis. Folkets Röst directly rejected this victory for the radical wing and printed extensive rebuttals by moderates like Christian Holtermann Knudsen and longtime friend Olav Kringen. Locally, the split nearly obliterated the Minnesota Socialist Party in Minneapolis, though a left wing emerged to exclude Thomas von Leer because of his affiliation with farmer labor politics. A.O. Develd retained a socialist identity but cooperated with the promising political coalition of farmers and workers. Voicing a similar opinion, Folkets Röst built a substantial circulation equal to his pre-war record at a time when other leftist publications were failing. Mengsel's view that at the ballot box, all who in some way worked against capitalism, radicals, moderates, and even those not wholly capitalist, were natural allies, made him see the mission of his newspaper in broad terms. It was perhaps this conviction that led him to give complete and favorable coverage of the farmer labor movement. It is also obvious that in his stance, he was greatly influenced by Devil's position and legislative successes on behalf of labor. Following the Red Scare, socialists lost much of the appeal of farmer laborism, and the support of this movement, which seriously challenged the Republican Party in the state, represented both continuation and political expediency. Circumstances both in the homeland and in Minnesota, the latter constituting the major determining motives, caused the majority of Scandinavians, even those who listened to the voice of Goapo and Folkets Röst, to find the middle way in their promotion of social reform. Thank you.